Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll. And I'm of the opinion that we don't talk about games enough. At least we don't talk about games enough in an intellectual sense, in a sort of the theory of games. What are games? Why do we do them? Clearly, there's a whole bunch of people playing games. I just looked up the numbers online, and we spend over twice as much on video games these days as we do on movies, despite the fact there's a lot more coverage of movies in TV and magazines. Two-thirds of American households play video games, or at least have someone in there playing video games for more than 3 hours per week. So video games pervade our lives, as do games more generally, right? Chess, Go, card games, etc. But what is a game? What's the definition of it? And why are we so attracted to them? Why do they fascinate us so? I think that my cats, Ariel and Caliban, in some sense play games. Ariel at least plays fetch. But we human beings go to great lengths to invent completely arbitrary rules, play by them, and then invest enormous amounts of emotion into whether we win or lose or how we do playing this game. So today we have on one of the world's leading people who does think about these issues in detail. Frank Lance is a very active game designer. He's designed a number of video games, Gearheads, Drop 7, which is a famous iPhone mobile phone game, CSI, Crime City, as well as various real-world games where people are out there in the streets actually playing by certain rules. But he's also the director of the Game Center at NYU. So his part of his job is to take the bigger picture, to really ask what games are, where they're going. So this is a very fun conversation. I do have to admit that it was in an extremely unusual setting that we had the conversation. This was a live recording at the Santa Fe Institute's Interplanetary Festival in Santa Fe, which is a very fun event. But to be honest, the recording was in a big space, in a big tent with lots of other things going on. So the amount of background noise is considerable. And what's worse, I wasn't using my own equipment. I was using the local equipment there. And the good news is that Frank's microphone was really good, so you'll hear him well. My microphone, sadly, was not as good, and also I was, because of that, trying to project, so it sounds like I'm shouting the entire time for the entire podcast. But, you know, I've done what I can to save the audio file, make it as listenable as possible. And like I said, Frank, who's the one you're there to listen to, is actually very clear in this recording. So I think it's such a good conversation on the substantive level that it's well worth listening to. So let's go. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Frank Lance, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
Thanks, great to be here.
So I don't want to put into words what it is you do, although I've already done that in the intro, but you both design games and have this sort of academic position. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, what are the games that you've been responsible for?
Well, I'm a game designer. I've been making games for a long time and also teach game design at NYU. I sort of do both of these simultaneously. The game design department is in the Tisch School of the Arts, okay, which is the same school that has the film school and acting and things like that. And the idea is that the instructors there are also practitioners. So, you know, we are professional game developers and people who have an ongoing career and a practice. And so that's what I've been doing for many years now. And as a game designer in New York, I made a lot of weird kind of experimental games. I had a small studio called Area Code. We specialized in location-aware games and street games, games that took place in physical spaces that incorporated computers but weren't on computers.
So they weren't video games in the traditional sense.
Yeah, instead we were sort of taking advantage of the emerging kind of ubiquitous computing technology to create new kinds of game experiences that brought back social interaction into the mix. So I did a lot of games like that. I taught a class in that style of game at NYU, and the students in that class made a game called Pac-Man Hatton, which was translating the game of Pac-Man onto the grid, onto the street grid of New York City.
Cool.
So that's the kind of thing that that we did. My studio did a bunch of games. We made a bunch of large-scale social games for Facebook. We also did a game called Drop 7, which you may be familiar with.
An old favorite of mine. Okay. I spent many hours playing Drop 7 on the iPhone.
Nice, nice. And yeah, so I've made lots and lots of games over the years. And then recently, a couple of years ago, I made a game called Universal Paperclips,
right,
which was the sort of first time that I had sat down to program a game myself from scratch. And so that was a fun experience, and that's the most recent thing I've done.
You can take over your life programming something like that.
It was deeply satisfying and a learning experience.
I should mention I'm very new at this in the sense that this is the first ever time that Mindscape has done a live podcast. So for those of you listening over the podcast radio internet network, we are here live at the Santa Fe Interplanetary Festival. It will also explain why you may hear noises in the background, like what I think was a theremin was just going on, but it may very well have been an alien creature talking its special language, because we're here at the Interplanetary Festival, anything can happen. So that's okay. We're all about experiences and new ones and seeing how things go. So one of the wonderful things I like, Frank, about your work is that you have designed games, you've programmed games, you've coded, but you also think carefully about the bigger picture, which is my favorite thing and our favorite thing here on Mindscape. So let's just be as big as we can. What is a game? What qualifies some activity as being a game rather than being something else?
Well, I think of game as a cultural category. So it doesn't have a very precise definition that will allow you to distinguish between things that are games and aren't games in some kind of automatic way by looking at their internal characteristics and identifying them. Instead, it represents a kind of a broad category of human action. And I think of it as being a creative form and something like an art form, an aesthetic form. So something like literature or music or film, dance, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's going to have all the same kind of ambiguity to precisely identify what is or isn't a game, but to me, it is the art form of interactivity. It is the creative form of designing experiences for people. You're still trying to create something meaningful, beautiful, interesting, popular, expressive, but you're doing it by crafting people's interactions, by crafting their choices and their actions.
So I like that, the art form of interactivity. So the I apologize to the audience. Like I there's an audience in front of me, so I feel I should project my voice to them. But the podcast listeners will be like, "Why is he shouting on the podcast? He doesn't do that." Sorry, take it into consideration. But interactivity then clearly, so that's the thing. Like it doesn't matter that there's a goal, it doesn't matter you can win or lose, it doesn't matter that there are other people, it's that there's a matter that you're not just looking at the work of art, you are interacting with it. That's what makes it a game.
Yeah, and I think things like having a goal, win state and loss state, those are the kinds of things that lots of games do have. So, you know, when we're looking to identify whether something's a game or not, having those qualities make it more likely that it's a game. In the same sense that music is about sound, But, you know, in some cases, music might be about silence, right? So the absence of sound doesn't mean that it's not a piece of music.
Sure.
This famous John Cage piece, you know. It just is like, these are the kinds of things by which we, it's like a family resemblance thing. You know, Wittgenstein famously sort of used game, the word game is an example of how hard it is to define anything.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but yeah, there's these family resemblances. They do tend to be about goals. But not always. And not recently, always. Game designers have really been exploring the space of games that are explicitly not about goals. So that's
you know, I went through a phase when I was quasi-active in Second Life. I don't know if you ever did Second Life.
I didn't myself, but I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Well, I got into it because there was a podcast that was in Second Life. So there was an interviewer and so forth. Jennifer, my wife, hosted, was one of the many hosts of this podcast, and I gave public lectures in Second Life. My impression was always, for those of you who don't know, it's a massively online game in some sense, but they never, so you had an avatar, there was a world, you built a virtual world. There weren't goals, though. It was an open world in the broadest sense. It was like, here it is, here's your play box, here's your sandbox, go play with it. And I think it kind of faltered because of that. There's other virtual worlds like World of Warcraft, other games, that are much more popular because you can still build the world, but there's also a way to win or lose moment to moment.
I'm fascinated by Second Life. I think it's more interesting now in its moribund state as this, like, abandoned virtual world.
Yeah,
you see people, like, take tours of it like they're going to Chernobyl, you know, and there's just these big, strange, decaying ruins of corporate sponsored, like, avant-garde art locations. It's very weird and cool. Yeah.
Well, it was weird to me because it's Second Life, it tried to mimic life. Like, you could have a house. We had a house. We had a cat in our house.
Yeah.
But then you could apparently just walk into other people's house and rifle around, and that was weird, and you didn't know whether that was okay or not.
Yeah. I mean, I always thought the sort of fascination with virtual worlds it happened in like the 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah.
It was a little bit misplaced. You know, the idea for me as a game designer, what was interesting about World of Warcraft was not that it was a virtual world that happened to be a game. It was that it was a game that incorporated a virtual world, right? And the fact that it was a game, I thought, was a really important part of that experience, right? Because a game, like a virtual world, has the implication that this is just another type of social space. But a game is a kind of theatrical. It's kind of like expressive. Like, we know we're entering into a kind of performance.
Performative.
And and so it's important in World of Warcraft that it isn't just things like, you know, race and politics. It's this strange representation of race and politics. You know, and I was a horde. I was a troll in World of Warcraft, and of course there was a Horde versus Alliance, and it was this, you know, big kind of underlying motivation for your play, and, you know, I hated the Alliance,
of course,
but it wasn't real hate, right? It's not real hate taking place in a virtual space. It was this strange kind of performative hate, which is similar to, you know, what you get when you are performing in a play or looking at a painting or reading a poem. You know what I mean? I think that's the important thing.
But it can also bleed over into the real world. I mean, fans of one sports team can be very not friendly with fans of another sports team.
It's true. And I think when you get violence in sports fandom is where you see a failure of the kind of ritual transformative aspect. I think when it's working, sports fandom gives you this kind of strange toy version of the kind of totalitarian identity that we get when we just feel like, oh, I'm disappearing into the mob. I become a Mets fan, or I become a Yankees fan, and I get to experience the pleasure of what it's, you know, what it feels like to get rid of my actual identity, all the nuance and subtlety of being a person and being part of all kinds of different communities. And instead, I get to plunge into this simplistic, atavistic, you know, thing. And that's kind of be beautiful because it's not real.
You could be a member of a tribe without all of the terrible baggage that can sometimes go along with that.
And it works because we know in this, even when we commit fully to it, it is bracketed in a way. And that to me is part of what makes, you know, sports and games in general feel like they belong alongside the arts.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Well, one of the things I noticed in Second Life with this podcast that Jennifer was a host of was, so she would interview people, like you interview people in a podcast. She would invite them on, and they generally wouldn't have Second Life characters already, so they would design them from scratch. And you saw there were only two types. There were like the people who designed the most sexually attractive version of themselves, right? Yes. Like buff and beautiful and glamorous clothes. Right. Or people who went completely crazy. They were a unicorn or they were a flock of butterflies. And mm-hmm. and that freedom to be something completely different was very valuable to them.
Yeah.
But it's still, they're still expressing something that was inside their real selves.
Yeah, and I think you see that in role-playing games as well. When people design avatars for themselves in Morrowind or any kind of RPG. They're playing with identity in that same way.
And it brings us back. I should have asked this even before. What is a game? What is playing? Like, cats and dogs play, right? It's not purely human. Mm-hmm. I actually have a cat who plays fetch. She's like a little puppy. She'll bring it back, and her brother won't do that. But so somewhere along evolutionary time, presumably, like everything else in evolution, we developed some mental machinery for some reason and we repurposed it for another reason.
Yeah.
So the hunting and the gathering or whatever got repurposed as play. Do we know a lot about the evolution of play and what purposes it serves?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a deep scholarship about play that comes out of anthropology and also sociology and psychology and development science. And I think one of the things that's fascinating about games is that it taps into this deep and ancient form of behavior, which is not only there at the beginning of human culture, but really predates human culture.
Right.
There's the sociologist Huizinga, who wrote this famous book called Homo Ludens, which is about how play really is the origin point of human culture. Like,
really?
human culture and civilization comes out of play.
This sounds
and the
like
play instinct.
One of many grandiose claims that you could either believe or disbelieve equally well.
Yeah, it is, but we like Huizinga, so we're going to give him okay. We're going to give him the nod in this case. But as for what it is, I think it has something to do with the power of free exploration. A lot of what we do is kind of bound and guided by our goals and our rules of interaction. And then some things we do are more exploratory. They're more improvisational. They are they're more unbounded. They involve things that are maybe random or trial and error. And we're if I pick up this bottle, I know what I'm supposed to do, which is hold it up to my lips and drink it. But if I just pour some out on the table,
oh my God, you did it!
that's playful, right? Because I'm exploring the range of possible actions I can take with this bottle, and it's not just the ones that we think of immediately, because we're kind of programmed to behave in certain programmed ways. It's all the different ways, all the different things I can do with this bottle, right? So that's play, and I think that's one half of games. I think what's super interesting is that in games you get this idea of play, wild improvisation, kind of unbounded, energetic, excess and imaginative kind of exploration, and it's also in conversation with the opposite, with structure,
yeah.
Rules, with goals, with arbitrary goals. Like, oh, I'm going to, tie one hand behind my back. And now what can I do with this bottle? And so these two things are kind of in conversation in games, right? Play and rules, kind of freedom and structure.
Rules seem to be one of the things that goes almost inevitably along with the concept of games, right? And like you say, we make them up. It's always been psychologically fascinating to me that we invent rules and then we stick to them. Like, we invented them. Or the goal. Like, okay, win your golden prize for playing the game a certain number of times on your iPhone this week. But then they become very important to us despite the fact that we know they're entirely arbitrary.
Yeah. And in games, we get to play with rules and we get to submit ourselves to them. We get to experience the pleasure of being bound by a little arbitrary system, and there is a particular kind of pleasure there. But then we also are given a chance to recognize how rules are constructed. Like, as a game designer, my job is to make rules, and as a player, we encounter a game, we voluntarily step into it, submit ourselves to the rules, but then we finish, we stop playing, and we step back, and we realize, oh well. That's the characteristics of this little set of rules, but it could have been a different way. And even as a player, you get to play with the rules. You say, what if we do it again, but this time let's tie both hands behind our back, or this time, let's not try to do this thing. Let's try to do this other thing, right? And so it gives you a sense of how rules are pliable.
And if I'm playing solitaire, let's say I'm playing with real cards, not just on a phone, and if I lose, if I can't, finish the deck, I feel bad. I'm tempted to cheat. Like, why is that?
Well, because I think part of what you get from a game is this little sense that you're being tested and that it's a little puzzle. Solitaire is like a little puzzle. And when you do well at solitaire, it's partly a reflection of the fact that you're smart. And so when you do poorly...
So it's your self-image.
Yeah. So it's almost like wanting to take your temperature again to see if maybe you could... get hotter,
You gave this wonderful talk for the audience out there. You should look online for a talk that Frank gave that involves two games that he compares and contrasts, Go and Poker. And let's take them in order because they're both fascinating for their own reasons. Go, of course, it's Japanese originally, is that right?
Chinese originally,
okay. It's to Asian cultures what chess is to Western cultures. And it's very formal and rigid and the rules are very clear. And people get into it, and you make this wonderful analogy that it becomes like a martial art in some sense. It's a form of discipline to become a good Go player.
Yeah. Go is an example of the kind of game that is a very hard, deep cognitive problem, like the kind that scientists wrestle with, but totally separate from the idea in science that you're working on a problem for a particular reason, because it fits into some larger framework, because by solving this problem, you'll be able to solve this other problem, or because it might lead downstream to some engineering breakthroughs. In the case of Go, you are just wrestling with that problem for its own sake.
You invented it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a very deep and beautiful game, and it's been around for thousands of years, and it's another great example of how strange games are as an art form, because... there are not that many works of literature or music that people have been interacting with for thousands of years, and they're still doing it in the same way. They're still getting a similar kind of value out of it. They're still thinking about it and participating with it in a similar way. Yeah, and it's a remarkable game.
We'd be remiss if we didn't mention the computers are now better than humans.
Yes, it's this great example of how games are often the sort of ultimate test bed for artificial intelligence. And Go is this iconic kind of quintessential AI problem, which just recently tumbled and maybe is the sort of last kind of fully full-fledged human game that humans are really good at.
Well, we'll get to poker in a second.
Yeah.
It took longer for computers to win at Go against the best Go players than at chess.
It did. Right? And people, I think, a little bit overinterpreted that. They were like, oh, well, chess, of course computers are going to be good at chess because look at it. You can see that it's combinatorial and you can just crunch through and look at all the possibilities. But Go requires intuition and deep insight and all these kind
really?
Of ineffable. I think there was a sense of that, maybe especially among game designers, for whom one of the beauties of Go is that it does require intuition. And there is an ineffable quality. Like you talk about things like shape and these kind of nebulous concepts. Like it's not just sitting down and crunching through. If I go there, you go there. I go there, you go there. You actually do have these hard to pin down concepts. And so I think people thought, oh, well, this will be our bulwark against AI and it'll last for a long time. But of course, it didn't last that long.
So for those who have never seen it, how big is the Go board?
19 by 19.
So it's 19 by 19 grid and you put either white or black pebbles
down, you can alternate stones. Black and white stones.
So, I mean, part of me wants to say, I'll be a scientist here for a second. It's a finite game. There's only a finite number of things that can happen.
Sure.
But the other part says, but that number is really, really big.
It's
so
big.
Of course, when real human beings play Go, just like playing chess, we don't in our brains try to go through every combinatorial possibility. We use heuristics. We use our intuition. We look at the shape of the board. We get a feeling. You talk about the energy that comes off of different configurations of the pieces.
Yeah.
And of course, then you ask the computer to do it. I heard a talk here at Santa Fe Institute, in fact, by a former professional Go player who, like many professional Go players, gave up when the computer won because they can't compete now with the computer. But one of the things we learned was one of the things that was holding the artificial intelligence back from becoming a really good Go player was that they trained it on human games first. And it actually turned out to be much better if they just let it play against itself without ever poisoning it with human intuition.
That was the real headline with AlphaGo, is that it got so much better when we stopped trying to seed it with the centuries of knowledge that humans had developed. With all of our insights, all of our heuristic, all of our ways of teaching Go, we just left that out. And instead, we gave it the rules, and then we gave it a technique for playing against itself and a preference for winning. And it did so much better. It was really kind of an interesting lesson there about humility.
And some of the players used words like it was playing against an alien because the computer used concepts that the humans hadn't thought of before.
But it was still beautiful. Like, the thing is that the Go experts who were watching AlphaGo still found the moves that AlphaGo made that were surprising to be exquisite. And so that was exciting to me.
There is a beauty there, absolutely.
And it's a beauty that is, on one hand, non-human or inhuman, because it surprised us and came out of... And on the other hand, deeply human, because it is Go itself expressing itself. Like, it is... A project like AlphaGo is the result of hundreds of people, thousands of people collaborating and working together and building on each other's insights and knowledge to make this piece of engineering. So in some sense, it's deeply human.
I mean,
I think that's a nice thing.
It was humans who had the motivation to invent the game, right?
Yeah.
If the computer never got to play another game, it wouldn't get frustrated.
Yeah.
That's what comes from us human beings.
Yeah.
And that's why I like this idea of using games like Go almost as a tool of self-discipline, right? As a way, it's almost like a meditative, monk-like, or martial art-like practice of training ourselves to be a slightly better people than we are.
Yes, the way I like to think about it is that it's a way of thinking about thinking. Go itself is a way of thinking about thinking. And artificial intelligence is also a way of thinking about thinking. And when people play Go, I think this is true for as long as people have played Go, they've been doing a kind of artificial intelligence research.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Because I don't know what you mean.
Well, but they've been thinking, what's possible if I take this little isolated problem and devote all of my thinking, in fact, devote my entire life, like a serious Go player, like a serious player of any, you know, like truly deep competitive game, gives up the rest of their life
right.
to explore this thing.
And if that were World of Warcraft, we would say it's terrible.
Exactly.
But if it's Go, we think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Or chess.
And so in the case of a game like Go, which is about decision making, what they're doing is saying, I'm going to sacrifice my life in order to explore in the deepest possible way what it means to solve problems, to what it means to apply every fiber of my cognitive ability to solving a very precise and specific kind of problem, and to go deep and to like watch it unfold. And it turns out it's fascinating and beautiful. It's not trivial, even though it's an extraordinarily simple game with only a handful of rules.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, maybe this is the good place to mention the idea that if you just say games, especially in our modern culture where that has slightly the connotation of video games, people worry. It has a slightly disreputable connotation, right? Like, this is something that kids do. It's distracting them from more important things. If you had said chess or Go, maybe they would get the fact that that's a more elevated, sublime thing.
Yeah.
But is it really different, or all games have an aspect of this?
I think people are right to be suspicious of games. I'm a game designer. I've devoted my life to making games and playing games, and I love them very deeply. But games, by their very nature, have to live outside of ordinary life. And we should be suspicious of them. Like, I think art is the same way, right? People are also suspicious of art. You spend all your time, like, you know, reading these stupid books, you know, reading comic books you're obsessed with music, and you're like hanging out with your friends, playing that noise instead of, you know, doing something practical and useful.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, games occupy this weird space outside of our kind of ordinary system of values, and they should. That's their job, is to be out there doing weird stuff and exploring the edges of what we know and think and imagine.
I mean, so it's my part of my job as the podcast host is to be slightly contrary and play the devil's advocate a little bit here. So
okay.
Some Go or chess might be very beautiful. Even World of Warcraft can be beautiful in its own way. There are some games that are really, really simple, and yet it is hard to ascribe that same level of beauty to them, and yet they really get us. They get their hooks into us,
yes.
And they become addictive, right?
Yes.
There's one of the gaming companies called Addicting Games. That's what
yeah.
they shoot for. Maybe Tetris was the first very well-known one on the computer, but this is definitely a goal of certain game designers to make a very simple game that will prevent people from ever putting their phone down.
And I think we can look at slot machines as a case in point of this, right? Slot machines are games, I would say, and there is a very dark energy to slot machines. Slot machines ruin people's lives. Not everyone. I mean, there's some people who have a healthy relationship to slot machines, and they actually get some meaning and
yep.
pleasure and joy and beauty out of slot machines. And but
which
you know,
literally no skill, by the way, right? You're essentially pushing a button or pulling a.
Yes, yeah, that's the kind of the quintessential version of a slot machine is no skill. You can be an advantage gamer who finds slot machines and like exploits
sure.
Certain payoffs and use your intelligence to actually get a little bit of an edge. But let's just say in the case, in the classic case, a slot machine is just pure randomness.
I love the fact that there are slot machine tournaments.
There are. I mean, yeah, there are people who make a living playing slot machines. It's like, but anyway, the thing is, so slot machines do have a kind of dark energy. And we are right to be anxious about that. And I think good game designers know that they have a kind of aversion to that type of game. They recognize that they could do that. You can put that into your game. But most good game designers want to make a game that is more than just compelling. It does more than just cause the player to want to keep doing it. If they want to make the kind of game that they themselves love, the kind of game that after you've played it, you're happy that you did. And you look back and you say, oh, that added something of value to my life. Not, oh, God, I'm sick to my stomach because I've just wasted my time and energy and money. But it's never that simple, right? Because sometimes great games can have a little bit of dark energy in them. Just like great art can have a little bit of dark energy, a little self-destructive energy, right? And so we want to be careful not to be too dogmatic and to say, oh, well, we can apply this moral filter to games and understand what's good and bad about them. Because the role of games, like the role of art, is not just to be good or bad, but to explore what being good or bad means, right? And you can't do that if you start from a starting point where you're like, well, I know what bad is. Bads are, slot machines are bad. That's what addiction is bad, right? Yeah. No, so part of what a game, like my game Drop 7, I hope, which I think is kind of addictive, has addictive elements. Oh, yeah. What I hope, I really hope, is that it's not just addictive, but it is in a sense about addiction. Like it gives people a kind of a toy version of a thing that is a little bit like heroin, but also a little bit like Sudoku, and a little bit like Tetris, and a little bit like a painting, or a little bit like a rug, or a little bit like weaving. And it takes all of these things and combines them in a way that I hope gives people some insight and perspective into how their mind works. And why they enjoy it, not just a kind of like a black box that they disappear into. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, but I want to say parenthetically for the cosmology aficionados in the audience that this is a different sense of the word dark energy than we use in cosmology.
Or is it?
Yes, it is. It definitely is. But do we know anything about the neuroscience of what makes it addicting? Are there some games that just poke your dopamine receptors?
We do. The psychologists know a lot about sort of reward schedules. In the case of slot machines, for example, what makes them so powerfully compulsive is that the rewards are intermittent.
Yes.
That we we're not able to predict them. And so these famous experiments where rats, they push a button and they always get a pellet, they'll do that until they've had their fill. But if they push a button and occasionally get a pellet, they'll do that until they die.
Unpredictable.
Yeah,
right.
They'll do that. So this kind of intermittent reward schedule is a big part of what makes something truly compulsive. But I tend to be a little bit skeptical of that. Like sometimes I will get calls from journalists and they'll be like, tell me how these evil corporations making these addictive mobile games are using these psychological principles. And I have no doubt that these big companies do employ psychologists, but I actually don't think it's that easy. And because I think if it were, everyone would do it.
Yeah.
Right. I think even in the case of slot machines, if you talk to people who design slot machines, they don't always know what is going to be popular. they'll try a bunch of different kinds of slot machines. And it turns out, oh, this Golden Girls machine is doing amazingly well. Or this Batman machine is a turd.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So there's still this sense of trial and error. And in some sense, it's still a kind of a creative process. And I think for me, in terms of games, the important thing to remember is games are culture. Games are not primarily technology. Games are a form of culture that has this deep relationship to technology. But they are not simply technology. They're not simply devices. They're not things that you plug in and then you get a hedonic, pulse, and that they're like a coffee machine. Instead, they are more like hats. You know what I mean? Like, why did everyone wear hats for a while?
Yeah.
Why did every single man in every social space wear this same hat for a while? That was all people did, right?
Yeah.
Is that addiction? It's weird. Like, so I think games, even addictive games, have that weird element in them, which makes them hard to just, you can't just plug in a formula and guarantee that you'll have something popular or compulsive or successful.
It's never happened to me, but has it maybe happened to you that you've been playing a game so much that you fell asleep and while you were dreaming you kept playing the game?
Yes. In fact, I'll tell you, the game that did that to me in the most powerful way was a game by David O'Reilly called Everything.
Okay.
It's a beautiful game. If you've never played it, I really recommend it. You can play it on the PlayStation, and it's an exploration of the thinking of Alan Watts, the great philosopher. And David, who's this brilliant genius, made the game in such a way that if you stop controlling it for a while, it sort of automatically starts playing itself. and so if you just put the controller down, after a while, it'll slowly start to just kind of randomly do actions and move through the space and explore it. And I was playing it very late one night. I was very tired, and I was already kind of in this loopy kind of state of mind, and I'm listening to the voice of Alan Watts, you know, talk about transcendence and mindfulness. And I was drifting out of consciousness. And then occasionally I would wake up and the game would be playing, and I wasn't even sure whether it was me or not. Yeah,
yes.
It was a really beautiful experience.
Wow. Yeah, I think that there's a lot to learn that we don't yet know about the psychology of this. My personal theory about Tetris and even Drop 7 and these other games were that there's some threshold where every time you lost, you felt, well, if I had done one little thing better, I would have won. So therefore, yeah, I should play again.
I think that's the mark of a good game in many cases.
Yeah.
In many cases, what we're trying to do as designers is create just that experience where I lost, but there was meaning to my loss. Like, I understand now what I should have done differently. And so what the player is doing is building up a little model of the system that you designed. And they have hypotheses, and then they do little experiments. And I think there's a lot of kind of like toy science in a lot of games. And so,
yeah,
this feeling of the player kind of wanting to understand what you've made and going deeper and deeper. So that feeling of like, oh, I know what I want to try differently this time. Ooh, I love it. I also love it in a game where I get this feeling that, ooh, something here is broken. I bet I can exploit. I bet there's a thing here
down
that the designer
edge
has not thought of. And so I'm going to use, you know, like an axe, and I'm not going to wear any armor. And I bet I'm going to get this weird. And so that feeling of something being almost broken, or the potential of it being broken, to me, that's catnip.
Well, it goes back to, you know, your self-image, right? You're
yes,
playing a game to get reaffirmation that I'm pretty clever here.
I am pretty clever.
Speaking of being pretty clever, let's switch from Go. We got off Go
okay
a little bit, but this idea of a sublime martial art that we use mm-hmm to train ourselves to poker, which is actually one of my favorite games.
Ah.
And you wonderfully contrast this idea of sitting in the tranquil Zen garden and playing, you know, very slowly and deliberately and engaging your most rational mind to the degenerate gamblers that we get in the poker
yeah
community in Vegas.
Yeah, it's these
are Mississippi riverboat.
The two games that I played most, you know, deeply in my life, in some ways are very similar, but yeah, they have this very, because Go is sort of like the beloved of game design snobs, and it has this, it's this ancient game with its kind of like a sacred ritual, and there's a lot of respect and a kind of a deep culture. And then poker, of course, is the game you play when you're crouched down next to the slot machines, and you know, they've set up
you
a little table, and yeah, you're listening
background
to the chime of the slot machines, and they're bringing you free drinks, and you're not even sure whether, you know, you're good or not. Because you think you're cleverly exploiting some edge that you have, but maybe you're not. Maybe you just suck and you don't even know, right? So it puts you in this totally opposite frame of mind.
One of those fascinating things about poker for me is that it is clearly advantageous for you if your fellow players think you're an idiot, because you can exploit that.
Yeah.
But there's such an enormous psychological desire for your fellow players to think you're brilliant,
yes,
that you resist taking
yes
advantage of that.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful game because it involves all of the kind of cognitive problem solving that goes into Go, right? There's still lots of math in poker, lots of ways to apply yourself and develop a kind of, you know, serious scholarly discipline to really plumbing the depths of how this thing works as a system. And at the same time, it's deeply social. It's so much about tapping into your ego and the ego of other people. Also, how we predict each other, right? The models that we have for each other's behavior.
It's the most crucial thing, having a model of what your opponents are going to do and then manipulating that model by talking to them, by not talking, by hiding.
But it involves a kind of empathy. Like, you can't be good at poker unless you can put yourself into the shoes of your opponent and think, oh, what are they thinking? And then they're doing the same thing to you. So you get this strange reciprocal quality. What are they thinking I'm thinking? And it's just, it's mind-blowing, which is one of the things that led John von Neumann to invent game theory.
Right.
But he looked at poker.
One of the smartest people of the 20th century.
Yeah. And he was like, oh, he compared poker to Go. Poker to chess. And he was like, well, chess is not really a game. Chess is obviously just a math problem.
Yeah, we just haven't solved it yet.
Poker, now that's a game. Because it involves this conflict between people where it's all about what I think, you think, I think, right? It's this deeply convoluted back and forth of modeling each other. And that's what, you know, he wanted to understand.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And yet, Jim McManus, who's a writer who wrote a wonderful book about poker, point out that at least for a long time, every poker book had six shooters on the cover of the book. Even though they have nothing to do with playing poker, there's this image of outlaw, of degeneracy, of living on the edge that is the opposite of the image that we have in chess or Go.
But I do love the mythic figure of the gambler. And it's, to me, it's always been a romantic
thing. Yeah.
It really is a romantic ideal because I think what the gambler represents.
The aliens are landing here somewhere nearby, but we're going to press on.
What the mythic archetype of the gambler represents is the person who has trained themselves, or by their very personality, has a taste for variance, a taste for risk. If you're willing to eat risk, you can profit from it. And there's something powerful and strange about that, because I think randomness, risk, probability, these are things that, as humans, we're still trying to wrap our heads around. We still don't quite understand how to think about them.
We're even terrible.
In physics, there's this like deep debate about how to interpret randomness,
like philosophy, we don't
whether
have
it exists.
Of probability.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And here we have in poker an art form devoted to it, which in its own way is about getting at some of the same questions about how does the world work? Is everything deterministic or not?
Yeah, you know? But the idea of expectation and the idea of not being results oriented is one that I love. In Go or in chess, there's a right or wrong move in every circumstance, even if you don't know what it is. But in poker, you might make the best possible move and still lose.
Yes. And which is what makes it so incredibly maddening, right? You can work so hard and you can be sitting at a table of people who are only there to party. And they've never once thought about how to play or what the right move is. And you can be playing at such a high level and they can just be making the donkiest moves ever, and they can take all of your money, and they can do it over and over and over again, and it's just soul crushing. But that's what makes it, to my mind, beautiful, because you have to overcome that kind of soul crushing quality.
Yeah,
and that's the sense in which poker can be a spiritual discipline, just like Go was. You know,
we should give some practical advice to the audience. You know, if you want to make money playing poker, Vegas, 2 a.m. when you've not been drinking is the best time to play, because there'll be plenty of people who are there just to have a good time.
Yes. If you want to make money at poker, come play me tonight. Sean and I are going to have a game, and we're just terrible. So.
But it's a different kind of game, because it's in some sense more realistic than Go. It hasn't been abstracted down to this pristine set of situations. It's a game of incomplete information. We don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
And that's some of the fun.
And I also think it's a harder AI problem for that reason.
Empirically, it is.
Yeah. Because it does involve this kind of reciprocal modeling and guessing. And it's the same kind of AI problem if all you're trying to do is develop a cast iron strategy that is not exploitable. In other words, if all you want to do is develop a strategy that no one else can have a strategy that will get money from it, right?
On average, you can tie at worst.
Yeah, a perfect strategy in that sense. That's just a trivial, I mean, it's a hard problem. But in some sense, it's a knowable problem. We understand how to solve that kind of problem. And it's, but if the problem you're trying to solve is how can I make a strategy that is flexible enough to adapt to the poor play of my opponents in a way to maximize the edge I have against other players who are not playing perfectly, then you have a higher level problem, because then you have all of the psychology of interpreting people, understanding what their strategy is from their actions, and they might be doing it to you at the same time.
If Go is human, then poker is even more so for exactly these
reasons. Yeah, poker is superhuman.
And you have this wonderful quote from Phil Ivey, who is arguably the best poker player in the world right now. I just saw it last night, so I don't know if you remember the quote or I should give it.
You give it and I'll tell you.
Roughly speaking, Phil Ivey, you know, just chit-chatting with other poker players in the middle of a game said, "You know when you lose so much money that you can't breathe? I love that."
Yeah, he said, "That's what I'm addicted to.
That's what I'm addicted to."
And it was beautiful, right? Because this was, I think, in Poker After Dark, one of these other great TV shows. And so he wasn't even aware that necessarily it was kind of like in the background in the chatter. And it was very honest. And as soon as I heard that, I got chills. This idea that's that weird feeling of being sick to your stomach, that pain, like that is the thing that he was addicted to. I was like, I recognize that. And again, there is a darkness there. That there's a kind of destructive energy. That's not a good thing. I'm not here to tell you, oh, this is all sweetness and light and poker is wonderful. And you know, like, no, this is, it's horrifying and it is destructive. Right. I mean, but it also can be kind of deeply meaningful and deeply beautiful. So that's what I'm addicted to.
But it's also a central part of gaming. It's not just poker where you lose a lot of money, but even if you're a spectator, we just finished the NHL and NBA playoffs, right?
Yes.
Most teams end their season on a losing note. Most fans are disappointed at the end of the season because they didn't win the championship. There's that sense of loss being not inevitable, but at least likely, is a big part of what brings us to these games.
Yes. Unless, like me, you are the North, in which case I was very happy.
Okay, well, yes. There you go. But you didn't know that ahead of time,
no,
right?
I didn't.
Like, I, as a Philadelphian, I would say that you kind of got lucky that Joel Embiid was sick during the playoffs.
Perhaps.
All right. Yeah. Despite all of this masochism and love for variance and losing and so forth, games are art, right? I mean, it is. How should we societally change our view?
The word art is so overloaded.
No, let's go there.
It's something similar to an art form in the same sense that, you know, pop music is an art form. It's a creative form. It's an expressive aesthetic form in that sense. I don't think you can dictate to culture how culture should interpret things. I think culture is so complicated and nebulous, this process. I try to contribute in my work as a teacher, as a designer, as someone who is out giving talks and stuff. I do try to get people to be aware of what it is that people who love games, what it is that they love. Because I think it can be confusing. Like, if you're outside of the world of games looking in, it can look like nonsense. It looks like an explosion in a cartoon factory. Yeah. It's like, what is happening? This weird, violent junk that my kid is obsessed with. And I do hope that I can help people who look at that understand, no, part of what your kid is doing is deep problem solving. Part of what your kid is doing is exploring a complex system and forming hypotheses and trying to get better at. Part of what your kid is doing is developing discipline. Part of what they're doing is social and collaborative.
A big part.
That doesn't, you know, in some cases, you know, people's, yeah, some most kids play too many video games. You know, they probably do.
And sure.
There's always
a balance.
Yeah, but understanding what is happening under the hood, and what is valuable about that, I think is the first step toward developing kind of collectively, evolving into a more sophisticated audience, right? With that demands better games, right? That has a more subtle and refined sense of taste for what makes a good game, and pushes the art form in the right direction.
I was at a conference maybe 15 years ago, so just to put it in social context, but it was about science and drama and narrative. So it was mostly about scientists talking to writers and English professors. And some conversation was happening, and I came up with the idea. I raised my hand and said, are we going to think a few decades from now that the newest, most exciting form of storytelling is games? And everyone said, oh, no. that's not stories, because like stories, there's only one thing that happens. You can't have a story where you're not sure what's going to happen next. I think maybe we know better now.
Yeah, I think some of the most interesting stuff that's happening in games is these new forms of storytelling. And both in a traditional sense where you just have great characters and kind of rich world building kind of woven into game experiences. And also in the kind of avant-garde sense of exploring what a story is, like what a story can be, and new forms of narrative and new forms of storytelling. There's a lot happening in that world that's really interesting.
And for the audience, because maybe not everyone is calibrated here, compare the size of the video game industry to the size of the movie industry right now.
It's bigger. I don't know. It's contentious.
People spend a lot more money on video games.
It's contentious, but I think by most measures, it is basically the sort of biggest pop cultural industry right now. So when a game like Red Dead Redemption 2 comes out, it's not just the biggest game launch in history. It's the biggest kind of entertainment launch in history. In terms of overall scale as a commercial industry, it's immense, which is great for me because as someone who is excited about the creative possibilities, I get to kind of like tag along, right? I get to hijack this rising tide, this commercial tide, which is not my primary interest. I want to make games that make money.
Yeah.
I want people to buy my game, but I'm mostly interested in the creative potential, right? It's good. It's a good, healthy, I think, mix, honestly.
But there's a difference with other forms of mass market entertainment in that there's some barrier to entry. It's siloed a little bit. Like when a really big movie comes out, everyone knows about it, whether or not they go to see it. Whereas there's huge numbers of people who have no idea what you're talking about when you talk about Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe less and less so over time. Like maybe that's just a generational thing. And, maybe...
Does every 20-year-old know about Red Dead Redemption?
I think it's a pretty well understood touchstone of culture.
Yeah.
As much as like, what's an I guess
the
maybe
Avengers.
The Avengers.
Yeah,
maybe it's not as well known as that. But it's partly because the Avengers lives or dies as spectacle.
Yeah.
Whereas Red Dead Redemption has because it is an activity. And a hobby almost lives and dies by a slightly different cultural logic. It's not just about imprinting itself as an image and
less
in people's heads. It is about creating a place and a space that draws people in. And so maybe that's part of the difference. Right?
And you've highlighted the interplay of emotion and logic, I think is how you put
it.
And there's certainly a way that a video game can be where it's purely pristinely logical, right? You're adding up numbers or, getting the shortest path. And there's also a way a game can be, I shouldn't have said video, any game.
Right.
Where it's more experiential, more emotional, more about how you're feeling in the moment. And is it slightly overgeneralizing or is it okay to say there's a sweet spot where they're both engaging?
I don't think of it in terms of a sweet spot where you have these two things and they're in conflict. Instead, I think you have these two different mindsets, right? The kind of logical, rational mindset of, that's maybe reductionist and kind of, conscious problem solving. And then you have the mindset of this kind of emotional, intuitive, imaginative, improvisational mindset that is more fluid and less kind of logical and analytical. I don't think of those things as being opposed necessarily. I think they're kind of woven together in a game. And so for an example, you take the game chess. Which in one sense is this kind of purely logical exercise of problem solving, analytical problem solving. And yet the chess itself is something like an art form. You're doing this analytical problem solving because you find it beautiful, because there is an emotional connection to it, because you find it expressive and meaningful and beautiful in ways that you can't precisely articulate. And so in a sense, this logical problem solving is embedded in something that is entirely illogical, right? It's not logical to devote your life to playing chess. It's highly illogical.
Depends on what your motivations are, right?
Yeah, yeah. But we do it because we find it beautiful, and we find it meaningful, and so these things I think are wrapped around each other. It's more of a fractal structure than it is a kind of a dialectical structure.
Certainly, something even with chess or Go, there are styles of play, right? If you thought of it as a purely logical
yes.
expression of trying to win, you might not think there should be styles.
What makes Magnussen thorny in his play? I forget how they describe his play,
right.
But he's known as someone who is like stubborn and and all he's doing is solving a math problem.
Yeah.
But it shows you that even in the realm of solving math problems, there is nuance. There are deep kind of heuristics that we will never get to the bottom of, right? Even when problems are well defined, the path that you take through solution space can be totally irreducible.
Individualistic.
Yeah, and an expression of who you are as a person.
I remember I was on a panel once with Garry Kasparov, who I like to introduce him as the last human being who was the best chess player in the world. Right?
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
it's computers who are the best. But he said something I thought was very interesting, because his personal style was very aggressive, very mm-hmm. fast, and there was a conventional wisdom that was not the right way to play.
Yeah.
And he said when the computers came along, they played that way. He felt redeemed.
Yeah.
Right? He felt vindicated that way.
You know, it's funny when professional chess players talk about play, they often use concepts from poker. This is another thing I love about games, is that when you go deep on any one system, you find these resonances,
sure.
right? And so they talk about, there's a lot in professional chess, tournament level chess play, there's a lot of predicting what your opponent's going to do. What openings are they going to bring? What things are going to work well against them?
Because you want to spend your time thinking about the right pathway.
Yeah.
Right?
And
yeah.
you can also have bluffing in chess, right? You can make a move and like hope that your opponent thinks it's a good move, when in fact you don't know for sure whether it is or not, but you're trying to kind of like
yeah.
Rattle them, which I just love. I love this mix between these. We think we have these categories. We think we know the difference between logic and emotion. But I think games highlight the ways in which these things bleed into each other.
And I like the idea having styles in these different kind of games. It's a different aspect of this fact that games help with self-discovery, right? Not
yeah.
just self-discipline, but self-expression, sort of figuring out who we are.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think any game that you play is an opportunity to learn something about yourself, an opportunity to be on this... this path of self-improvement, self-overcoming, you know what I mean? Like this path that I personally want to be on as a human, where I'm not just good at what I'm doing, but I'm kind of improving my idea of what good means. Like what type of person am I trying to be, you know? And I think games give you an opportunity to do that. You don't have to do, and most games are not
sure.
like that. Most
That's
people
okay.
who play games aren't doing that. Many people
Battle
who play
Royale
games,
is really not
they're just
gonna...
wasting their time and they're just disappearing into a pleasant experience. And that's great, you know. But I think along the way, there's always this potential. And that's what gets me excited.
If we think about the history of game design, are we getting better at connecting with the sublime in our games? Is that something that is valued in the community?
I think we are. I think we are getting better and better, which is not to say that it's like a simple, straightforward path, you know, that over time we just get better at.
Yeah.
Instead, it's this weird, circuitous
Work
thing, like
it.
All forms of culture. Are we getting better at music? And yet there are ancient pieces of music that I find deeply moving. And so I think games are similar. As a design discipline, I do think we are developing new methods and better kinds of best practices and a sense of how to do this really difficult, challenging task slightly better. But it is irreducible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one aspect of the self-discovery is, given that there's an aspect of being addicted or being in a zone and losing yourself, there's another aspect of games that let you become more conscious of processes that were unconscious, right?
Yeah.
You had that wonderful example of a game where you tried to just walk with
oh,
four keys
yes.
on the keyboard.
Walk.
And you realize that walking is
yeah.
really hard
yes.
if you have to tell your legs what to do.
Yeah, this wonderful game by a close friend of mine, Bennett Foddy, who also teaches at NYU, Yeah, Quomp, which is just a game where you're walking. and it's hilarious because it what he did was this create this incredibly convoluted control scheme where you control like different limbs and so it turns this trivial thing into this deeply complicated thing, but you can get good at it.
I did not get good at it in the 10 minutes that I spent.
Give yourself time.
Okay, maybe I won't. So what do you think? If we should wrap up a little bit. Two things. You can answer which one first you want. One is speculate crazily about the future of gaming. I mean, will it become a bigger and bigger entertainment behemoth, or will it sort of blur into the cultural milieu so that games are everywhere in some sense? And the other is, I'm sure we have a heterogeneous audience in terms of some people are avid gamers, some people have never done it. Mm-hmm. For those who have never done it, how should they approach games? Are there certain games they should think about playing? Is there a gateway drug?
I want to answer the second question.
Okay.
Because the first question, it's too hard to predict culture. I mean,
have to answer both. You can just choose which one.
I'll do the first one first, then I'll just knock it out of the park and then move on. Right? The job of a game designer is to answer that question, right?
Exactly.
Every game designer is trying to figure out what the future of games is and is going to be and what it should be. And so in the process of making games, we are actively fulfilling that kind of role of predicting what the future of games is going to be. So that's my short answer to that. The second question of a lot of times people come up to me and you know, what kind of game should I play? How do I get into this world? What I like to tell them is find a game that your friends are playing and play that. Like it's so much more important that you play a game as part of a living community than that you play the right game. Play a game that other people are playing that you can then talk to them about it. Like you can learn from them. You can say, well, what did you like? What did I, you know,
yeah.
I didn't get very far. I'm stuck here. Or that you can play with them. And sort of like think about the game as being part of a social practice where people communicate with each other through the game. I think that's more important than playing just the right kind of like little masterpiece that's going to like this whole idea of masterpieces. Do you know what I mean? We have a running joke in game design about Citizen Kane. You know, where's the Citizen Kane of games? But I think games by their nature are so squirrely, right? They are so evanescent and they're so weird that they don't fit into that little tidy box of what a masterpiece is, right? They don't fit into this thing where, oh yes, I can take an object and put it on a pedestal and look at it and see its characteristics and thereby get some aesthetic experience because they're participatory. And so so it's less important that you play Cinco Paus, the greatest game that you can play right now.
Okay.
It's a game I love by my game designer named Michael Burrow. It's more important that you play something that you have a context, a social context for, and that you can talk to people about and learn and be motivated to participate in.
So, I mean, there's an introvert part of me inside that says, but I just want to ignore other people when I'm playing games. But then I remember that, you know, a really good poker table really matters. The other people you're playing with is a huge part of the experience.
It's really true. I often think if I were in a place and I was given an option, I was with a bunch of people and I was given an option, you can go into room A and play this game that you know is a great game, but play it with these people who are maybe a bunch of jerks. Or you can go in this other room and play a game that maybe is not so good in its own, but with these wonderful people that you love and you think are really interesting and clever, it's always better to do the second thing.
There's a lot to think about the future of this. I think that we're just starting, really, with where games can go. So, Frank Lance, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Love being here.
And Santa Fe and the Interplanetary Festival, thanks so much for having us. And thank you very much to the audience for helping us with this experience. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip, can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.